mistake. I was thinking in single dimension. I wasn't thinking of that pattern in 360-degree azimuth and elevation. And single dimension really limited my thought, so you broadened my horizons for sure. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Good to have you back, John, and to you.
Yes, yes. Now, one of the early, very good books on antennas is the Radiation Laboratory series of McGraw-Hill books, published roughly 1948, right after World War II. Tremendous amount of radio research and development took place in World War II. And when they wrote it all up in the Radlab series, book number 11, I think it is, or number 12 by Silver, called Microwave Antennas. In there, there is a footnote by Mr. Condon. He discovered that when it comes to radar-type parabolic dish antennas, they all have a main lobe and multiple side lobes, and the back lobes, that if you've got a sensitive enough receiver in your airplane that's flying and near that that radar, as the radar antenna turns, you'll see the main lobe hit you, your airplane. You'll see those individual side lobes and back lobes. And he discovered that the individual side lobes and back lobes have different polarization characteristics, different beam width characteristics. So the first guy to recognize that was Mr. Condon. And therefore, sometimes those crazy lobes are called Condon lobes. Every antenna has them. One of the hard things to believe about every antenna you've ever seen, let me drop it, is that every antenna you have ever seen, touched, looked at, studied, whatever, radiates some amount of signal in every single direction in space. Every antenna radiates in every direction. In some direction, we have things that we call nulls, where the signal strength in that direction gets very weak. It never goes to zero. You choose one of those directions where you think you've got an extremely deep null in your antenna pattern. You use a sensitive enough receiver. You will measure the amount of signal in that null. Once the signal is coming out of that antenna, some amount of signal is going into absolutely every direction. The only thing left to discuss is how strong is the signal in that direction, and what is its polarization, bandwidth, and beam width. But it radiates everywhere. There is no such thing as a signal direction where the antenna puts out nothing. You can carefully tune the antenna. You can make a null 30, 40, 50, 60 dB suppressed compared to the main lobe. You'll never make it minus 300 dB, so to speak, complete zero, so to speak. It just doesn't do that for a whole bunch of complicated reasons. So on top of that, the antenna pattern that you see plotted on a piece of paper, it could be a three-dimensional pattern, and you take a slice of that pattern and you display it as an XY two-dimensional polar plot. Let me drop that. There's an amazing number of people that will look at that antenna plot, which the polar axis, the strength of the vector from the center of the polar chart out to your antenna pattern, that tells you how strong the signal is in that direction. That is a representation of signal strength versus direction. That pattern doesn't really exist in the real world. If your eyes operated at radio frequencies and you looked at that antenna while it's transmitting, would you see that pattern? No. If you slow down the signal, if you did a slow motion movie picture of the signal being radiated from the antenna, the signal would be a whole bunch of completely smooth spheres that are expanding at the speed of light, but you've got a slow motion movie, so you're seeing these spheres slowly get inflated like a balloon, and certain portions of those spheres are brighter because the signal is stronger in that direction. In certain directions it's dimmer because the signal is weaker, but there are completely smooth, round spheres of signal radiated from that antenna at each instant of time. Each one of these spheres is one wavelength, so to speak. And because there's a whole lot of individual cycles coming out of the antenna, you got a whole bunch of these spheres expanding from that antenna. That's what your eyes would see if you could see the antenna radiating. Let me drop. Once you realize that's what's really happening, it suddenly gets you away from that misinterpretation where people look at that antenna pattern, they think it represents range. And I worked for a company where the hold-on company was sending out a request for quote to antenna manufacturers where they looked at a particular antenna pattern. They interpreted the antenna pattern in range. They wanted an antenna where the signal coming out of it went to exactly 10 feet in the major direction and completely stopped. They asked for an antenna to be built where the signal would go out to 10 feet and completely stop. You can't do that. Once a signal is radiated from an antenna, it goes to infinity in every direction. You can't stop it from doing that. You radiate a signal from your antenna, it goes to every cubic meter of this universe. You wait long enough, it gets there. It may be very weak when it gets there because the range is so great, but it goes everywhere. I had to stop them from sending out that request for quote because a whole lot of antenna companies would have been laughing at them. It's a tremendous misinterpretation of an antenna pattern. That pattern does not tell you range. With a particular sensitivity of the receiver you're using, let me drop, and a particular amount of gain in a particular direction, with that particular receiver, you can predict a certain amount of range in that direction when using that antenna at that amount of power. So by a three-step process, you can interpret it into range for your environment with your equipment, but it's not because the signal only goes to that range. So it's an amplitude representation of the antenna pattern. And where the antenna pattern comes from in an antenna. Why does it have that main lobe and those side lobes and that back lobe? I won't go into that tonight. That's another whole area that's highly misunderstood. You ask the average electronic engineer, what generates that pattern? The answer you're probably going to get is, well, the antenna operates by this equation. You plug the numbers into that equation and you get that pattern. Yeah, that's true. But where does the rubber meet the road? How does the antenna do that? And the answer is a hell of a lot simpler than you think, but we're not going to go there tonight. Okay, Eric, give us a few words on where we stand with the COFDM. Let me drop. If I understand correctly, the channels above UHF television channel number 35, all those frequencies between 35 and 51, have recently been sold. Customers have made a commitment to pay, or they have already paid for those frequencies. They want to start using those frequencies. Therefore, the current over-the-air television broadcasting on those frequencies has to, in some time in the near future, stop, and we're going to switch over to the new protocol, the new method of transmitting over-the-air digital television. And because there are 27 million households in the United States watching no-pay television over-the-air right now, even though there may have been proposals in the past to get rid of over-the-air television, I'm convinced that will not take place. We've got too much tradition worldwide. There's always going to be over-the-air television as I see it. So how soon are we going to start seeing action where we have to start buying a new television set or new converter boxes with those coupons we're going to get? How soon is that going to start taking place? Is there any prediction of that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. Hi, let me fill you in on the latest. Okay, this is, I think a week ago. The FCC approves voluntary adoption of next-gen TV broadcast transmission standards. Is ATSC 3, which, by the way, the standard is not finished yet. It's almost done. They feel that you deploy ATSC 3 on a voluntary and market-driven basis, right? And then one of the commissioners made a comment. Let me let it drop. Oh, here it is. Let it drop first. Commissioner Clyburn said she supported the proposal, but still had questions about the transition to ATSC 3, including how small stations that don't adopt the 3.0 would be affected, as well as the cost to consumers since there will be no converter box subsidy like implemented in the 2006 digital transmission. So I think that says a lot to start with.
If we're not going to get coupons for buying the converter to switch over, and if there are no sets out there right now with the capability of getting COFDM, you can have voluntary switchover of a broadcast station. Why the hell would anybody volunteer to do that? If you volunteered to take Channel 21 over to the new ATS-3 standard and start transmitting that right now, nobody on planet Earth in the Western Hemisphere would be able to see your signal. What in the world would motivate you to do that volunteer? And if you're not going to do it now, what's going to happen a year from now and 2 years from now? Why are you suddenly going to volunteer when there are no receivers and you'll be all alone when you do it? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, K2RIW, K2EJ. First of all, actually there's a station in Oregon with a number of translators that are actually trying the Korean version of ATS-3, which they're actually now distributing in their country, which is actually the system layer, the physical layer, the RF link layer, and the surface usage reporting, and the audio watermark and video watermark, and the audio common standards have all been, done and approved. There's more stuff that we're going to do that's still not part of the standards yet, which the Koreans don't use, so they actually have a working system in which to do some testing with. Now, I'm not going to change right away, but I don't know if you've been in the stores at all lately, but you might have noticed that they're selling more and more 4K receivers than you can possibly imagine. Let me let it drop.
I was just in Walmart yesterday buying my soundbar, and I saw a lot of very exciting pictures of 4K, and I can see how they're going to sell that. The prices are not huge. The display looks beautiful, bright, and very high in resolution. You can hold your eye a foot away from a 60-inch screen and see some nice, fine details. So I can see how that's going to be popular. I wonder how many broadcast stations in New York City are transmitting 4K at this time. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
I'll answer your question. None. It's impossible with the standard that we have. We don't have enough bandwidth to, even with the high-level compressions that we have. We need 30 megabits to be able to get that picture out. And actually, right now, if you buy a 4K, you can buy a DVD player that plays 4K, and there's movies that are coming out on 4K. And you can get DirecTV, and they have a 4K channel. And you can get Dish Network or Echo Star, whatever you want to call them. They've got a 4K channel, and some of the cable systems are now beginning to put some 4K stuff up there. But when you're connecting to your 4K receiver, you're doing it via an HDMI cable. You're not getting RF from anywhere, so you're using whoever decoder box, whether it's a cable system or a satellite provider, or your DVD player, which provides the signal for your 4K set, which might actually have a ATSC tuner in it. I'm going to drop again.
Is it possible by an RF channel, 6 megs wide, to transmit 4K? I think you're going to tell me with 8VSB, no, but with COFDM, maybe. Over to you, Eric.
No, not maybe, definitely. That's the whole point of ATSC3. ATSC3 actually will not only be able to transmit 4K and multiple, 1080i HD pictures all at the same time, but includes, the receivers will actually include a internet connection, so it becomes a two-way system. The stream capabilities are actually able to do a lot of interactive stuff, so your TV set will all of a sudden become more interactive than it is now with the smart TV receivers that are out there. Yes, actually, the ATSC standard allows you to create a ATSC3 standard allows you to create 36 megabits worth of stream, which is mucho. It's almost double what we currently have.
Well, I'm getting 36 megabits of display on my screen in a 6 meg channel. My guess is there's a certain refresh rate. If I'm watching the movie Grand Prix in 4K.
Stop thinking analog.
Okay. Will a sweeping picture, like you've got in the movie Grand Prix, where you're panning the particular race car and the background is whizzing by at 180 miles an hour, and therefore, if you wanted that not to smear and have artifacts, you need a ridiculous update rate. With a 6 meg bandwidth channel with ATS3 displaying a 4K picture, can that system keep up with that continuous display of that particular movie? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, we have more efficient coding than what you're used to seeing. You're used to seeing something called MPEG-2. And its spatial response is limited to the map that it uses. This could be, an all-right conversation about video compression, video codecs. But yes, the refresh rate is really built into the algorithm that you use, okay? If you're shooting something at 30 frames per second in a race, you know that you're going to have certain kinds of artifacts that you're just not going to get away with. That's why some folks like to transmit 60 frames a second as opposed to 30. You get double the spatial resolution. The frame rate of a 4K picture is still going to be 60p. Okay, or 60 full frames per second. And how you derive that depends upon the motion that's there and the algorithms that you use to predict motion. We actually now predict where the motion's going to be and create a series of numbers that says that car is going to be at this pixel at this point in time in the future. And there's some interesting ways that we do that. I'm going to drop. That whole concept of prediction is actually built into MPEG-2, but the amount of bits that we use to calculate and the size of the coefficients that we create are the limiting factors. And basically, a MPEG frame consists of something called an I-frame, which is an information frame. There's a B-frame, which is a bidirectional frame. And there is a P-frame, which is a predictive frame. Each one of these, each frame other than an I does not contain all the information about that picture. Okay? The successive bidirectional frames, which may actually have a little bit of stuff from a previous frame and a little bit of stuff from a frame that hasn't been transmitted yet, you're sending that information to the processor when it's doing the reconstruction, that it actually has stuff ready before it needs it. Because the video picture isn't fixed, it isn't a constant bit rate, it's constantly changing, and it goes low, and the transmit only needs a little bit of data, and there are places where it needs a lot of data. And you can use that to your advantage in terms of being able to push enough bits for the right moment of time and then release them when you don't need them. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, while I was in Walmart yesterday and I'm looking at these 4K pictures, I realized that none of it was over-the-air broadcast. All of it was a canned program coming off a video disc, I'm guessing.
Probably a USB stick, believe it or not.
Okay. So, but it was a canned program. Some skiers coming down a hill in a very scenic area, very high-skilled skiers, being shown over and over again. None of it was over the air broadcast, I could tell. So a person buying that set, wishing to see that kind of picture, by way of media he can buy and connect to his set to an HDMI cable, he can get that picture. I think currently with our ATS2 or whatever it is system that we've got right now, he's not going to get that over the air for some time to come. And so my real question right now is there enough things for him to buy? I guess by way of satellite and cable, he might have enough to watch if he's willing to buy all the premium stuff. But How soon are we, the general public, going to have to switch over our TV set? How soon? How soon is over-the-air ATS-3 going to be available? And I get the impression that our ATS-3 and the European equivalent is sufficiently different that very unlikely am I going to buy a European TV set and use it in the United States with the new system. So once again, we're going to have a protocol that is reasonably unique to us. We've got 6 meg bandwidth of channels, they've got 8 meg bandwidth of channels, and the actual details of the COFDM are going to be a little bit different with us. So it's sad that we haven't designed a worldwide television standard by which mass production of television sets could really take place and knock down the price. Over to you for comments on any of the above, Eric. KE2EJ, KJRIW.
KJRIW, KE2EJ. Well, let me take you back a couple of years. In terms of the production standards, it's pretty much a worldwide standard. Yes, there's something called 1080i60 and 1080i50. Okay, all the production seems to be done in actually 1080p or 4K nowadays, and it will be translated to the appropriate standard simply by taking that file and sticking it in the box that understands what it's getting and it spits out what it needs. The standard that they use in Europe is called DVB-T, or DVB Terrestrial. Actually, ATSC is part of the DVB standard. It's an actual DVB standard with some modifications that make it, there's a level of it that we use in the transmission world called ASI, or asynchronous, well, now I can't think of it. But anyway, that standard ASI is worldwide in terms of getting pictures and sound and data and that kind of stuff back and forth. The signals are pretty much standard agnostic in terms of you can stick anything in and it goes. It's kind of the way it's designed because it's not IP, but actually the ASI can be stuffed into IP and transmitted over the internet or however you want to do it to get it from one place to another. The actual transmission standard, that's where the differences are. Hang on a second while I'm going to drop. So the COFDM of DVB-T will not be the COFDM of ATSC-3. Japan, Korea, United States will be doing ATSC-3. ATSC-1, as far as anyone knows, is not going away. So if me and Channel 13 decide we're going to do ATSC-3 and transmit 4K, we would probably do the following. Now, the interesting thing about ATSC-3, let me just put this out there, is it allows for, and it actually does work for doing distributed transmission. Meaning, you can do it sort of like telephones, where you can put little transmitters on telephone poles to, widen your coverage area and have them all transmitting the same stuff synchronously. So any TV receiver anywhere can pick it up. And it doesn't actually have the problems that I've been running into running synchronous FM radio transmitters, which is a real pain in my rear end. But I've managed to make it work reasonably well, but there's still areas where the timing of the two signals make it sound real crappy. But so that's a plus. But the reality is that the ATSC-3, if we were going to start transmitting 4K, I would still maintain an ATSC-1 transmitter and put, let's say, on Channel 32, I put WNET and WLIW and World and Create all on my ATSC-1 transmitter so that people can pick that up. And in New York, I'd put the ATSC-3 transmitter or the river. They give us better coverage, but we wouldn't leave the folk just hanging there. And by the way, you're going to start seeing, once the standard is finally finalized, which is supposed to be at the end of April, the TV manufacturers will start including those tuners. And by the way, it's from channel 38 and above that's gone. So 38 is gone. The last channel, 37. K2RIW, K2Z.
ATSC, does that stand for Advanced Television Selection Committee, or Coherent? I guess it's Advanced Television Selection Committee, and their third standard. Okay, so in Oregon, if I understand,
that is the system.
Okay, system. So in Oregon, you've got some repeaters, or you've got some fill-in over-the-air broadcast that's being done with the new standard. But how soon are we likely to really see a change on the East Coast? The voluntary switchover, somebody's going to start transmitting it in addition to their normal transmission. They can't do a complete switchover because 98% of their audience are going to lose if they abandon the current standard. So as I see it, it's going to be a slower switchover than we did in, I think it was 2006, when we finally switched over from analog to digital over the air. I have the gut feel that this switchover is going to be a much slower one because lots and lots of people have bought brand new flat screen digital televisions, and the fact that they've got to either abandon that or put a converter box in front of them, it's going to force them a little bit. I think we're going to get a lot of gnashing of teeth on this one, Eric. Yeah. The fact that the new one is so much better, that may not be enough to sell it easily. KE2EJ, K2RAW, how soon am I going to really see something happen?
Well, I was reading something the other day that really surprised me. 4K sets have been on the market for a bit more than a year now. How many do you think they've actually sold?
The method by which they're selling them is so good. I guarantee they've sold a lot of them. There's a lot of people out there saying, okay, if I'm willing to go to a canned program, or if I'm willing to pay for the premium channel on my satellite or cable system, I'm going to see these beautiful pictures. So I'll bet you they sold an awful lot of them, Eric. Is that true?
That's very true. The number's approaching 12 million. So the manufacturer's very happy. And most of them do have an ATSC 1 tuner in them. And they have a jack for your ATSC 3 tuner option that they will sell for the older sets when it finally comes around. But if you spend the money on a 4K set, you either bought a player of some form or you've got satellite or cable, and you're already hooking a box to it. So it's not like you're not hooking a box to it. So I don't think that's going to be an issue at all.
What's the approximate price of a 4K set these days? I get the impression that the 60-inch version is around 800 and change at Walmart. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
No, I saw a Vizio, a Westinghouse, a Samsung. Of course, Samsung makes the best picture. I'll put the Samsung up against the Sony here with me. You can see the difference between them. The Westinghouse, which made not half bad picture, was actually better than the Vizio, was going for $399, and that was a 54-inch set.
Wow. Was that in Micro Center or Best Buy or Walmart? Where did you see that one, Eric? Go ahead.
A couple places. I was just in Micro Center yesterday.
You've owned a 4K set for how long, Eric?
I don't at this point, but at work we've got a couple of them. They've been around for a while, actually older ones. Vizio has been selling them for like $7.99 for 2 years now, or 3 years. Actually, people are actually using them, putting studios as glass walls.
Along with 4K picture content, and either 30 or 60 complete frames per second, and 1080i or whatever method of display, I think we've recently come a long way when it comes to the pixels themselves on that screen. At one time, the flat screen digital sets were a little bit shy on a white to black ratio, a CRT could do better on blacks. My guess is they've come a long way, and the blacks are awful good these days. Is that true, Eric? Probably with non-reflecting screens. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Okay, we're talking about contrast ratio, actually. Let me just put this out for people who need to understand the concept. When you look at your CRT when it's turned off, what color is it?
Sort of a gray. And to make it really black, it takes some more trickery, doesn't it, Eric?
Oh, you're really relying on your eyeball. You're trying to do something within the dynamic range of your eyeball. That gray is actually what you're calling black, but when you put it up against something that's bright, your eyeball sees it as black. So, let's just get that point across. The more the difference between no light and light, the blacker that kind of looks. And today's screens are far more efficient at putting out light per pixel than, say, the plasmas were that you might be referring to, if you want to go back 10 years. They made lovely pictures. They also made really unsmooth color. Most people don't realize it because they actually, when you fire off gas, you have to get to the point of where it conducts, and that makes light. And to change the brightness of it, you can't turn it off completely because it takes time for it to come back on. So what they do is they dither to create colors and to create shades of gray and brightness. But today's screens don't have that problem. Many of today's screens are no longer liquid crystal in front of a light source. They're actually little LEDs for pixels.
So I think you're telling me I'm looking at a zillion LEDs, millions of them, across that 60 or 54-inch wide screen of that 4K set. That many real LEDs. In other words, there's not a compactor, there is not a, what do they call it now, cold cathode fluorescent tube providing the illumination. Those are individual LEDs. And what's the life of those, Eric? What will that picture look like 5 years from now, in your opinion? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Oh, man, that's the beauty of this stuff. It'll look pretty much the same thing. Maybe a teeny shade darker in terms of maximum brightness, but nothing that you're going to be able to see. And the problem that you're going to see maybe in 10 years is when, you know, pixels start to fail. And it might not even be the LED. It might be some of the logic behind it. And then, of course, we're getting into OLEDs, which are organic LEDs, which have a much better contrast range and ability to do pulse width modulation on them that's a little more accurate. But they're going to have a life.
The Vizio set that I bought a few months ago, a 40-inch Vizio at some nice price at the Micro Center. What do you believe is the method of display that I bought? Did I get LEDs, Eric? Go ahead.
I suspect you have a liquid crystal that might be lit with LED blacklights.
LED blacklight, liquid crystal, as opposed to individual pixels of LED, and no compact fluorescent tube in there that's going to wear out, is what I think you're telling me. Go ahead.
Yeah, compact fluorescent tube for display backlighting is pretty much passe. I haven't seen too many of them anymore. They've moved away from that since the technology to make these other types of displays has become more commonplace.
Have these better displays worked their way into laptop computers? A significant amount of laptop computers seem to still have cold cathode fluorescent tubes that eventually give grief and a lot of EMI. So, are we, when it comes to display devices, are our television sets moving faster than our laptop computers? Over to you, Eric.
I don't know if you've looked lately, but there's more and more LED displays and laptops and iPods and that kind of stuff. iPads, rather, or tablets. That transition is happening now.
So once again, I'm sitting back here knowing that the ATS-C3 is on the way. How soon will I really see some action locally in the New York City area? And what is that first action going to be? Voluntary switchover where some of the major broadcast centers in New York City have an auxiliary channel with the new standard while they keep the old standard for a while? Is that what's likely to happen? Over to you, Eric.
Okay, New York City doesn't have any Sinclair stations. We'll see Sinclair go ATSC3 faster than anybody because they were the ones in the beginning in 1996 when the standard was proposed to go COFDM. That's been their mantra for forever. But there's a couple of different plans on how to do this. One of the thoughts is to a bunch of stations get together and they'll put their mainstreams at standard definition and pack them all up into one transmitter. And they will in turn put their 4K stuff on the ATSC3. By the way, you'll probably start seeing real ATSC receivers come the beginning of next year. So it's not that far away. As to how the change is made, it's going to be different in different parts of the country at first. And, you know, what's going to happen is the networks are going to get together and they're going to say, well, we're going to do it this way, and that'll be the way most of them will do it. But this is supposed to be a market-driven thing, so time will tell. Another possible choice is if you happen to have two transmitters or you have a group of transmitters that are translators, is that you might leave one of your transmitters as 1.0 and your main transmitter will become 3.0. That's another possibility. There's a number of different ideas about how to do this, and nobody's quite yet knows what exactly they're doing. K2RW, K2J.
Ordinarily, if I have a whole bunch of cell sites acting as broadcast transmitters, and I put a human being, I put a home somewhere in the middle of that matrix, I'm going to be getting a lot of co-channel interference. What is it about COFDM where co-channel interference is not detrimental, where it is a non-detrimental with 8VSB? I know in the case of 8VSB, inter-symbol distortion kills you real fast. How does COFDM survive that? Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
All right, well, any type of ODFM is, in essence, multiple carriers, right?
I accept that.
Okay, so let's say you got a matrix of 1024 individual carriers. And now, the data information, the symbol information, you've calculated the distance between transmitter A and transmitter B. And you delay the signals going into transmitter B by X amount of time that it takes for the signal to propagate from transmitter A, or you pick a point in between the two. And what you do is at that point where the two signals meet, you make the timing so that it is precisely the same. And then, of course, we're talking about television. There's zones in which you operate as to, you know, if you have a transmitter, like you have a Channel 13 transmitter, a Channel 12 transmitter in New York City, and there's a Channel 12 transmitter in Philadelphia, there's a point between those two where you don't want to be interfering with each other, okay? And that's why there's got to be a certain distance between stations. And anything that you do in terms of creating distributed transmission, as long as you stay within the boundaries of literally your grade B, as they call it, you don't have an issue.
Okay. I'm receiving that television set in my automobile. I'm midway between New York City and Philadelphia, and the timing there has been made perfect. And I start driving my automobile toward Philadelphia. The Philadelphia signal is getting earlier and stronger. Therefore, the timing is no longer perfect. How come I don't get co-channel interference in that area. Eric, go ahead.
First of all, you're not transmitting the same thing from Philadelphia. It's a different station. Okay? Normally, there is that zone between the two stations where you can't pick up either of them. And that concept remains. So, and we're not talking about when the band opens and you're getting a strong signal from somebody else.
I had the impression that your team has distributed transmission, broadcast transmission over the air that's somewhat like cell phones. As such, there are places where I can locate my automobile where I'm going to pick up multiple transmitters simultaneously. And yet I'm still getting a clear picture. How does that happen?
All right, well, don't forget, you're transmitting all these multiple carriers, and some of them are going to get affected, and some of them are not, and the data is contained within all of them to a certain extent. First of all, when you're talking about the distributed transmission system in Europe, which is all COFCM, there's also a limit in terms of how much power can be put out. When things are within normal conditions, depending if, you know, it had been decided through Langley Rice or some other series of programs that these are the areas that you can operate and have X amount of signal strength. And an opposing station that is somewhere else is not part of the distributed system, okay, because a distributed cellular system is designed so that the delays and the crossover points of each cell meet within a certain period of time. And you can actually have some reflections and a few other things like that happen, and the COFDM with its multiple carriers and the type of error correction that they use is able to extract your stream from it, and also predictively, because one of the things that we do is we send a little bit of data that talks a little bit about what's coming ahead, so you can actually reconstruct stuff when it gets messed up.
The newest converters for COFDM are therefore able to advance or retard one signal versus the other. How much can they do that? Can they go 75 nanoseconds, so to speak, or 300 nanoseconds? Over to you, Eric.
Specifics of what DVB-T is, I would have to look it up because I'm not very conscious of it. Just as much as that the equalizers in ATSC-1 version 3 was crappy versus version 5 or 7, it's the same, they went through the same process with the DVB-T.
When we switch over to the new system and we've got to buy converter boxes, in the old days they gave us 2 coupons per human being. I think the coupons are worth $20 a piece or $40 a piece, I don't know, to buy the converter. And I think you said this time around no coupons will be issued. What's the rationale for that? And are we going to make some very unhappy people? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Well, not really. Not if they maintain their stream on an ATSC-1 output. And the cost of these receivers is so cheap. It isn't, you know, it isn't funny. They're not worried about it. It isn't like, there's nothing in it yet that says you have to stop transmitting ATSC-1, so that may be 20 or 30 years down the road.
If we're not going to stop transmitting ATSC-1 at the current frequencies for that many years downrange, then the people who bought those new frequencies, aren't they going to complain that we bought something that we're not able to use? How soon are they going to be able to use the new frequencies that they have bought? And have they already put down the cash? Over to you, Eric.
The clock actually starts at the end of this month, and there's 39 months to complete the changeovers, and they get all their frequencies as people move. The thing that you're forgetting about, which I explained to you before, is that, okay, I can take 4 stations. I could take ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, and put them all into one stream and transmit them on ATSC-1. It won't look as good as that if they were running at their full bandwidth. They might not even be HD. But I still maintain them without having to take up 5 channels.
Okay. Ultimately, I'd like to believe that the new system squeezed into the lower channels, and we're not going to have blank channels that are adjacent to each other anymore. You assume the set doesn't have that adjacent channel interference problem and the near-far problem and dynamic range problems. We're going to make all these assumptions. Am I going to get full resolution over the air when it's finally established, when we squeeze everybody down to lower channel numbers? Over to you, Eric, KTRLAW.
Right now, you've got a channel, let's see, you got a channel 31, a 29, a 32, 33 is blank, because of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, is that 34, no, 33, no, I could be wrong about that. With ATSC-3, we have no problem putting one channel next to each other. Same thing with COFDM, by the way. The problems that you will run into is if you have co-located transmitters that are not exactly co-located, you want to make mixing products. That's why we're actually going to be fighting with the FCC because we're moving to World Trade Center, and we're going to be on 12, and 11 staying on, I think 11 staying on 11, but when the FCC okayed it, that was before 11 decided that they weren't going to move to the World Trade Center, they're going to stay at Empire, which actually creates a little bit of a problem up to the north, so we're going to be bargaining at the FCC about that.
Once again, who's staying at Empire? Which channel is that, Eric?
DIX is on VHF 11. When 13 moved to World Trade, or Freedom Tower, or whatever you want to call it, which we're actually going to start doing, I think in the summer with the gear comes, and we operate on 12, the original plot was for both 11 and 12 to be at World Trade, but now PIX or 11 decided they're not going to move to Freedom Tower, they're going to stay at Empire.
Is that an economic decision? And how in the world is PBS making us a different decision that's not being driven by economics? Over to you, Eric.
Well, the thing that I left out is that PIX forgot to tell the FCC that they weren't going to move. So what was that about economics?
I am guessing PIX said it's going to cost me a lot of bucks to move over to Freedom Tower, and I don't gain that much in performance, therefore I'm going to save my money. If that is the reason that PIX made that decision, how in the world did PBS not make a similar decision? Because when it comes to pure cash flow, I would not consider a PBS a super rich. Over to you, Eric.
I know I've explained this to you before in the past, but I'll do it again. You forget that with this auction is included, I think, $1.9 billion or $2 billion to move the station. So WNET or WPIX does not have to spend a penny of their own money to make this move. It's being paid for.
Okay. If the move is being paid for, and PIX is saying, hell no, I won't go, what in the world is their rationale?
You'd have to ask their accountants or their management. Actually, I know one of the people that probably has a part in it. Some people don't like to make changes. What can I say?
So the FCC made all the decisions assuming that everybody wants to move if there's enough economic incentive. They created the economic incentive. And by the way, where is the cash coming from to support that economic incentive? I presume ultimately it's part of my taxes. Is that true, Eric?
Absolutely not. It's coming from the consumer. Consumers that use cell phones. the cell phone companies, let me look it up. It'll, I'll tell you the exact number. They plop down, give me a second. I think it went for like $19 billion, all the space. Anyway, I'll find it at some point. And then of that, the Congress gets a billion something, and then there's a billion something to pay for the move, and that's not only to move the station, but to rework towers and everything else that it takes to move a transmitter site, or even new towers to some places.
So once again, the average broadcast network, like PIX, had they decided to move, they get how much dollars incentive for that move, Eric? You made it sound like it's $1 billion. I don't think so. Go ahead.
Oh, they probably get something close to, like, you know, 40 million or 50 million. I don't know what it is yet. Actually, in April, there'll be a whole breakdown of who gets what and how much they get. But if you take $1.9 billion, and I think there is, now I don't remember the actual number of stations. It's less than 1,000 now. You know, divide that into 1.9 billion, and then you, if you were to divvy that up evenly, you can calculate it.
Okay, when they sold the frequencies, now you're calling it 1.9 billion. Earlier you called it 19 billion. What's the rough number of the cash flow of selling of those frequencies? What did the new guys buying, how much money did they, in theory, lay down, Eric?
Oh, let me find the real numbers for you. Let's see. Sinclair takes in $313 million and swaps in proceeding. So, by the way, you're moving the station. You actually sold here. The forward auction closes at $19.6 billion. So, the PBN's incentive auction is now closed at $19,632,506,746. The auction itself is not over. Forward auction winners will next vie for specific frequencies. Let me dig a little deeper.
So $19.6 billion so far, 1,000 broadcast centers. In theory, you've got $19 million per, not counting a whole lot of other charges. And the $19.6 billion spent so far, there's an additional auction that's going to take place. The $19.6 is going to go to $21.5. Over to you, Eric, K2LAW.
Okay, here we go. The assignment phase is expected to take several weeks to give number of wireless licensing parcels and economic areas, or PEAs. The United States and its territory are divided into 416 PEAs compared to the 210 designated market areas of geographically defined TV licenses. Here we go. The final funds will be divided into $10 billion for 84 megahertz of broadcast spectrum, $1.75 billion to move TV stations into what's left of the broadcast spectrum, $225 million to pay for the auction, and $7 billion plus whatever is raised in the assignment phase to the U.S. Treasury.
So in very, very round figures, you could almost spend close to $1 billion. Is it a billion? No. 1,000 stations. Let's call it $10 million. Around $10 million per station, average, could be spent for the move. Is that enough to finance the move, Eric?
Oh, more than likely. If you've got, and it's not going to be evenly distributed, it just depends upon what you need to do. You know, if you're just moving from, Empire to World Trade, you're probably going to get less than the guy that's got a 2,000 foot tower, and he's got to move, you know, from UHF to VHF, means that he might actually have to either reinforce his tower or change the tower configuration, let alone change the antennas.
Okay, so how soon am I going to see something happening in the New York City area? Will I see significant action by December 31 of 2017?
Well, as far as you as a TV viewer, you're not going to see anything. Actually, next week we start putting in Channel 13 at four Times Square, and that'll become a backup site. Well, wait a minute, I think that's going to be Channel 12, because the combiner's ordered. The combiner has to have its own cavity. Right now, there's only, let's see, Channel 3 is on its own antenna, 7 is on a combiner, who else is there? Right, they put 7 into a combiner, and it's waiting for whatever other stations are coming. And so we're going to have a cavity put into that combiner system for our input.
Nobody's on Channel 12 right now when you stop moving over to it, Eric?
What's going to happen is we're going to build the facilities. We can't go to Channel 12 right now until some other folks change. So it'll have to wait for that moment. And this all has to be done, completed within 30 months, starting at the end of April, I believe it is. And so say Philadelphia moves, you know, a couple of weeks, or they set up their facility to move a couple of weeks after we change ours, and we decide, and the FCC says, okay, you can go there, we'll stop transmitting on 13, start transmitting on 12, and the receiver might have to do a scan again.
The nearest Channel 12 is in Philadelphia?
HYY, I think, is on 13 right now, but I think they move the same as we do. Again, the list is going to come out soon, and then you can know exactly who's doing what.
Who is the nearest guy on Channel 12 right now, Eric?
I'm not an encyclopedia, but I can look it up. Let's see, 12, I think there's a 12 in Providence, and somewhere else. Hang on, I'll look it up.
Okay. While you're looking that up, if we still have Glenn, let's see if Glenn's got a relatively brief question. N2ZEA, K2LAW. Go ahead, Glenn.
N2ZEA, thanks for the help, guys. I'm building a circuit. I need to bring the control voltage up to about 13.8 volt rail. I'm using a Darlington, and it's supplied by TTL Logic, but it only gives me about 12.5 volts. I can use a relay, but they're noisy and slow. So what's the correct solid-state device to use?
Okay. You're trying to switch. You want to control 13.8 volts. And you've only got 12 and a fraction to work with. You didn't tell us how many amps is required. The 13.8, maybe it's only a control, and you don't want to use an electromechanical relay because you're afraid it's too slow. I'm reasonably sure there are electronic relay equivalents. Texas Instrument, among other people, I'm pretty sure, sells a solid-state device that acts like a relay, and I'll bet you it moves in a fraction of a microsecond. Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Yep, yeah, I didn't know about those. Somebody suggested something about a FET device or a MOS device. Would something like that be appropriate, or do you still go with the solid-state relay?
Controlled pass transistor, it's very fast.
So, why would you want to build your own FET transistor network? Why not buy a complete package for a small number of dollars that does the electronic relay equivalent? I guarantee they exist, Glenn, go ahead.
I didn't know they existed. That's great. Okay, so I'll look up the solid-state relay. And are they controllable from TTL Logic?
That's the most likely logic. When you do flip that relay, in fact, I know you can buy these things in quite a number of amperes. When you do close that relay, how many amperes do you intend to flow through that solid-state relay, Glenn? Go ahead.
Just milliamps, 5 or 10 milliamps, that's all.
And I guarantee there's a tiny little chip that does that. You don't want to build that when you can buy it. Because one of the things that we as brand new engineers think that we can design anything, you don't realize that it takes a significant amount of time to debug the thing you just designed. If somebody's got something out there and they've been selling it for 10 years and it's got a good track record and it costs $2.50, you know, you don't want to design a thing like that when you can buy it. And I'll bet you can buy, at your level, I guarantee you can buy something for in that price range, Glenn. Go ahead.
Control pass transistor is up. For 60 percent.
Speak to HWW.
Howie, I bet you've already done that. How did you do it, Howie? Howie, I'm guessing you've already done that. How did you do it? WB2HWW, K2LAW.
Hello, I have to come on that.